Good morning. We're going to read John 13, 1 through 14. Jesus washed the disciples' feet. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour has come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During the supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from the God and was going back to God, rose from the supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking the towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What am I doing? You do not understand now, but afterwards you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, do not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, "The one who is bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, "Not all of you clean." When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garment and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and the Lord, and you are right, so I am. If then your Lord teacher has washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet."
He is risen. What Alan said was when you said you got up early, and Alan said, "If it was good enough for him, then it's good enough for me." That's a line. That's a bar, as the kids would say. Give Alan his due. Good morning. My name is Scott. I'm the lead pastor here, and it is Resurrection Sunday. And this is the high point of our calendar as followers of Jesus. This is quite literally the reason why we do any of this, week in and week out, day in and day out. In fact, one of the earliest Christian missionaries, teachers, theologians, the Apostle Paul was his name, is he said if the resurrection didn't actually happen, like really happen, like bodily, actually, historically happen, real event in real time and space, then we, followers of Jesus, are to be pitied, more than anyone else in the world, because we are about as misled, as misguided, and mistaken as any people if that event didn't happen. And what I would ask you to do today is, whether you're someone who often finds themselves in a church or not, is to just consider, what would it mean, just for the next 30 minutes, what would it mean if this were actually true? And the reason why I chose this passage to talk through this morning, normally we'd talk through one of the passages of Jesus' resurrection, but what I love about this passage, which happens about two nights, or really the night before, depending on how you sort of measure everything out, but the night before Jesus is betrayed and crucified, is Jesus does an action. He says many things that night that we have recorded in the various Gospels, but he does something that night that you just heard that I think casts as much meaning and understanding around the events of the cross and the resurrection as anything else that we have recorded. And so what I want to talk about this morning is how Jesus washing of his disciples' feet and the way that it points to the cross and resurrection provides for our greatest need and answers our deepest question. Provides for our greatest need, answers our greatest question. Provides for our deepest need, you might say, and responds to our deepest question. And so let's look at the passage together. It'll be up on the screen, but if you do have a physical Bible, always fun to follow along that way. Here's what it says. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour, this is significant in the Gospel of John. This is something that the whole a gospel is a telling of the life of Jesus. And the whole gospel has been leading up to this moment, to this hour. And by now, we've been clued in that this hour is really the events around Jesus' death and resurrection. So Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father. And having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, here's this word again, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from the Father and was going back to God, rose from supper, laid aside his outer garments, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. We're told a number of things that Jesus knows. He knows that this is the time of his departing from this world. In other words, he knows that his life is about to end. It's interesting to consider, if you knew that this was your last day on earth, if you knew that fully, with absolute, complete knowledge, it begs the question, what would you do? It is fascinating to ponder that Jesus was so unique in that he was a human being who knew full well that his end was coming. In fact, these are his last moments. You can think of it this way. These are his last moments of the experience of human freedom. From this point on, he will be arrested. He will be enchained. He will be led by others to his own ultimate torture and crucifixion. So these are his last moments to do whatever it is he wants to do. He knows that full well, is what we're being told. What he also knows is that the Father had given all things into his hands. In other words, probably this is best understood as the Father had entrusted to him what was most necessary in the world. The Father had entrusted to him a unique, you might call it a vocation, a mission, an assignment that God had given to him. And Jesus is fully aware of what that assignment is. In other words, what's about to happen here in any number of ways, and we'll mention a few more of them, but really what we're meant to see here is the action that Jesus does here. It's like the cross is casting its shadow. Though it's out ahead, it's casting its shadow back upon this moment. Jesus knows what he's about to do. And in knowing that, this is the choice that he makes. This is what he chooses to do. It says that having loved, he doesn't just know things. It also says, having loved his own who are in the world, he loved them to the end. This is such a beautiful phrase. This is quite literally, he loved them to the, if you know the word, this is a fancy philosophical word, but literally the language is here is, he loved them to the telos, is this beautiful word that speaks of ultimate meaning and purpose. What is your purpose? Philosophy, teleology, where that picking up on that word, is the study of ultimate purpose and meaning. The purpose for which the world exists, the purpose for which humans exist, that's the study of teleology. And it says, Jesus loved them to the end. And this is John doing what we've been working through John, if you've been with us. We've watched John do this a number of times. He's toying with two meanings here. He's saying he loved them to the end in terms of he loved them literally until his dying breath. That on the cross, as we contemplated on Friday, to his dying breath, he was loving us. He loved them to the very end of his life, but he also loved them to the end for which he was sent. He loved them to the fullest extent possible and to the fullest sort of purpose and meaning possible. You see, Jesus' death was not a mere example for us. It accomplished something. It meant something. That's what John is setting this up by saying. So knowing all of this, having loved us to the end, being fully aware, also you get the sense when this says that he had come from God, was going back to God. This is a very simple way of saying Jesus knew exactly who he was. He was uniquely the Son of God, the creator of the cosmos in human flesh, come to be one of us, to walk in the world as one of us. He knew that full well. He was not confused about that. That was clear to him. And all of this begs the question, well, in light of all of that knowledge of who he was and what he was here for, what does he choose to do with these last moments of human freedom? And it says, he rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. This is a wild action. This is wild. Foot washing in our day, like if right now I was like, all right, we're all going to wash each other's feet. You'd be like, oh, what a horrible way to spend an Easter Sunday, right? Even we have a reaction against it. And we have relatively clean feet. Feet at this time, man, you are walking on roads that have all of the muck of not modern sewage. All of the muck of, keep in mind, the roads are not walked up and down by automobiles. You're talking livestock. You're talking all kinds of mess that people are tracking in, such that what foot washing often was when you would go to a meaningful banquet of some kind, there would be servants of the absolute lowest class who would dignify that banquet by saying, this is the type of thing that requires your feet to be washed because we don't want you to sully the goings-on. And so this would be the lowest of the low would be sent to do this. In fact, in many provinces in the Roman Empire, it was illegal for a master to demand that their servant do this to them. It was that menial. This was like only reserved for certain times and for certain classes of the lowest of low servants and slaves. And so as Jesus rises from supper, we can imagine this stunned silence as what he's doing here. We're told that he takes off his outer garment and puts on the attire of one of these servants. Right? He's taking off his tie. He's taking off his nice shirt, and he's only leaving on his undershirt, and he's rolling up those arms, and they're saying, what is he doing? Because this seems like what he's doing is he's taking off what was customary, what was normal at that time, and he's putting on what he of all people should not be dressed as. You see, in this moment of him taking off and putting on, it's like a little miniature acted metaphor for Jesus' entire life. You see, what that same Apostle Paul, who said, if the resurrection isn't real, we're to be pitied more than anyone else, he said that the best way to understand Jesus is to say that though he was like actually God, like really and truly God, counter to all of our expectations, he took off those rights and privileges and took on the form of a human being, and actually took on the form not just of a human being, but of a servant, becoming obedient to his Father, even to the point of crucifixion and death. And so in this moment of Jesus taking off and putting on, it's like this parable of the entire, what in theology we call the incarnation, the God of the universe becoming a human being. And then he begins, on one knee we can imagine, he begins to wash the disciples' feet. One of my favorite renderings of this is a Renaissance-era painting by a painter who was nicknamed Tintoretto. I'm going to go over here. Tintoretto. And he was very fascinated by this scene. He painted a bunch of versions of it. But here you have Jesus, who, if you'll notice, in almost every other rendering of Jesus that we could imagine, Jesus would be in the center. Instead, we have, of all things, a dog. And of course, this is the painter rendering the scene in his modern context, right? This is not him trying to render what this looked like in the first century. So we're in sort of a Renaissance era palace and all of these things. And this is almost certainly Jesus washing Peter's feet. And you can see that there's almost comically over here, these guys are trying to get each other's pants off, basically, get each other's feet ready. So they're eager, but everyone else is just a little suspicious of what's going on. Everyone else is a little weirded out by what's going on, right? And the dog, the meaning of the dog, I'm sure you're curious about the dog. The dog means exactly what they tend to mean in our time, sort of obedience, sort of a trusted friend. It's an unlikely character to be centered, and yet it's saying that this is the level that Jesus has lowered himself to, but as an obedient and loyal one. It's sort of a wild choice to put the dog. In fact, when this was put in a church, they wanted the dog out. And Tintoretto said, no, the dog stays, basically. One of my favorite parts of this painting is in the back, if you see that there's this sort of watery thing going on there. That is almost certainly meant to represent the river Styx, which in Greek mythology, you know what that represents? Death, right? It represents death. And yet on the other side of death are two ancient structures associated, actually, with a military victory. It's the Arc de Triomphe, which it's not the actual one that's there, because I think that this would predate that. But this is where they got that in Paris, the Victory Arch, and then an obelisk. In other words, though Jesus is headed towards death, there's victory on the other side. Let's go. The shadowy figure back here is Judas, who we've already had mentioned, all the way in the back by there. In other words, he's waiting to greet Jesus and bring him to his death, and he's furthest away from the scene. What I love about this depiction is sort of the strange awkwardness of the moment. It's like no one really wants to give Jesus their full attention, because what he's doing is so very odd, except for the two who are sort of like, get me ready, you know? That there is an eagerness, at least for a couple of them, but for most, they're sort of standing in this awed silence. By the time Jesus gets to Simon Peter, Simon Peter is scandalized. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And the emphasis there is on the pronouns. Lord, do you wash my feet? Jesus, this makes no sense. You are our master. You are our Lord. Some of us are starting to deeply perceive, you're like capital L Lord. You're the God of the universe. And you're going to wash our feet. Simon Peter, we wonder, I wonder if Simon Peter's just the best. Simon Peter is the guy of Jesus' disciples who clearly is from Jersey. He just strikes me as the most Jersey. He's very impulsive. He's very quick. And the more that I thought and sort of pondered this, I wonder if Simon Peter thought this was a test. If he's watching everyone else get their feet washed, and then it comes to him and he's like, I get it. I wash your feet, Jesus. And one commentator describes Peter as proud to be humble. He's like, I get it, Jesus. I'm going to pass this test. You wash my feet. Am I right? Right? Like, come on, Jesus. And Jesus actually, for all intents and purposes, rebukes him. Jesus answered him, what I'm doing you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand. Peter says to him then, as though this is just upping the ante, you shall never wash my feet. And the literal language here is like so strong. It's like, you will never, ever, ever wash my feet forever, is the literal rendering of this. Peter is like, all right, you're pushing me, right? Like, you're testing me. And then the rebuke comes. If I do not wash you, you have no share with me, or you have no part with me. I think what we're seeing in Peter is responding as so many of us respond to who God actually is. You see, I think that, remember one teacher saying, so many of us think that our problem with God is that he is too high and lofty and afar off, when he's actually in some ways too low. What Jesus is saying here is, if you won't let me first serve you, you will not properly ever relate to me. And this is so, it's just so counter to how I think we think about God, which is like, well, yeah, God isn't a part of my life or God seems distant right now. And we can believe this whether we're followers of Jesus or not followers of Jesus, that God seems distant from me and it's primarily because I'm not serving him lately the way that I should. When actually what Jesus is saying here is he's saying, if you don't let me get that low, if you don't let me serve you first, and what he's saying, then my presence can't be near you because this is who I am. You see, Jesus does this. Jesus washes his disciples' feet, not in spite of who he is. He does it because of who he is. This is who God is. This is something that disciples are constantly saying to Jesus. They're saying, Jesus, it's been great knowing you. You're an amazing miracle worker. You're the Son of God, whatever that means. But could you just show us God? Like, show us God. Like, step out for 1 second and show us God. And Jesus, again and again, what does he say? If you have seen me, you have seen the Father. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I heard it, here's a fancy way to put it for you theology types, is that all theology at the end of the day is Christology. In other words, everything we can say about God, we can first say about Jesus. Everything we first say about Jesus, we're saying about God. This is who God is. Behold, this is the creator of the universe. And knowing everything he knew, understanding full well who he was, he takes a knee and washes feet. And he says, this is the way to know me. This is the only way to know me. I've got to get this low. I've got to clean, right? And this is obviously an analogy and a metaphor for just how deep. It's so beautiful that the image here is one of cleansing, because this is our deepest need, Jacob Swell. Our deepest need is always that we know. Now, we might arrogantly hide it. We might find new ways to dress it up, right? Like a lot of how the scriptures talk about what we do with our own sense of we are not enough, with our own sense that the Bible puts a name on that and says with our own sin, with our own rebellion, with the stuff that's been done to us, is it says we attempt to cover that. And we cover that in various ways. We cover that with different pursuits of the next great thing, of the next great achievement, of the next relationship, whatever it is. We cover it in our cultural moment with try on this this way of being in the world, try on this group of people to associate yourself with. And we're covering. And the Bible says again and again, you will never sufficiently cover because this stuff is way too deep within you. That superficial change can never be the way of dealing with this. Right? This is in Hamlet, right? Oh, out cursed spot, that famous speech that he knows his guilt. And there's a sense in which we all have a cursed spot that we know we can't cover. And Jesus says, that's how low my forgiveness and grace goes. I've got to go there though. No forgiveness, no presence. I must serve you first. You see, that's the rhythm of the good news of Christianity. This word that we use, gospel, the gospel is always God goes first. He loves so that we can love. He gives grace so that we can be dispensers of grace. He forgives so that we can be a forgiving people. He loves so that we might become people of love. But he's got to go first, right? A lot of us say, well, if I was a more loving person, if I was a more forgiving person, if I was a more morally upright person, well, then maybe God would choose me. And God is down at our feet going, just let me wash you. Made me think this week of Ernest Hemingway, one of my favorite writers. He would often put a story within a story to explain the story. And one of his lesser known, really, short stories. It's called Capital of the World. It begins with a story, and that story is about a young man named Paco in Madrid, Spain, in the last century. And Paco has gone off and rebelled and squandered his family's riches and done all sorts of things to bring shame to his family name. What Paco doesn't realize is that ever since he left home, and what he's trying to do is become a famous matador, you know, sort of the pop star of his day. What he doesn't know is ever since he left home, his father has been searching for him, going everywhere and checking in. He knows that his son maybe has been a waiter in various restaurants, so the father goes to these different restaurants looking for him. Finally, Hemingway says that Paco's father puts an advertisement in the local newspaper of Madrid. It reads, "Paco, meet me at the Hotel Montaña at noon on Tuesday. All is forgiven. Love, Papa." He goes to this hotel at that time on Tuesday, the father does, and outside are 800 young men named Paco, which is a common name, but far more significant than Paco being a common name, there is a common story that all of these men are responding to, which is, oh, that we would know that the one to whom we feel most responsible would say to us, all is forgiven. Come home. That's what the foot washing is. It's God's way, with open arms, with a towel around his waist, to say, just think of it, right? Like, one of the images that I can't get out of my mind is, as Jesus is washing these feet, think of how he himself is becoming what's been on them, right? He is becoming all of that muck and mire. I'm sure that this is part of the scandal for Simon Peter, is by the time he gets to Simon Peter, Jesus, at least the towel that's around his waist is starting to reek, most likely. In fact, in those ancient times, the way that you would do supper is that your feet would be as far away from the table as possible. You would lay on the ground to get that muck and mire as far away from polite community as possible. Now that's on Jesus. Again, this is but a whisper of the gospel, of what he will do on the cross, when that same Apostle Paul tells us he becomes sin who knew no sin. He himself, who had never done any of that, who was the only human being ever in the history of the world to not be complicit in the dirt and grime of this world, becomes all that, takes it upon him, goes as deep within him as it went within us, and dies in our place. And yet here's the good news of Easter Sunday. The good news is that there's a resurrection on this day. And there's a resurrection of one who emerges from that grave, especially in John's gospel. Is John is tripping over himself to express to us just how bright Jesus is when he emerges, just how bright that morning was, just how bright the angels are, just how shining their clothes were. In other words, that muck and mire and dirt and grime and stain and guilt and sin, it goes into the grave and it stays there. But Jesus rises victorious over it. Our champion, who takes it fully upon himself and then leaves it where it belongs once and for all. You see, the foot washing reminds us that Jesus in his death and resurrection provides for our greatest need. But it also responds to our deepest question. One of the most interesting parts of how this story is told is a mention of another thing that Jesus knew. In verse 11, we're told, "For Jesus knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, not all of you are clean." Here, of course, we're talking about the shadowy figure in that painting, Judas. A little further down, Jesus says in verse 19. Well, look at this. Start in verse 17. Do you have that for me? "If you knew these things, blessed are you if you do them. I am not speaking to all of you. I know whom I've chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I'm telling you this now before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he." Such an interesting interaction. So first of all, what's so crazy in this is Judas is there. And it says at the beginning of the passage, Judas already knew what he was about to do. It says the devil had already put it into Judas's heart to betray Jesus. This was going to happen. It says Jesus knew this. You know who got his feet washed that night? Jesus washed Judas's feet. You know why I think he washed Judas's feet? To show us there is no one, no matter what moment you find yourself in, no matter how far from God you feel right now, no matter what the enemy has put in your heart or what the enemy has caused others to do to you, there is no one who will not receive the cleansing service of Jesus. There is no one whose feet are so dirty that Jesus will not get down and serve you in that way. There's something else going on here, though. Is Jesus says to everyone else there, to the other disciples, hey, one of you is going to betray me. He quotes an Old Testament passage that talks about lifting your heel, which is either sort of a sign of insult or is like a horse kicking someone behind them. Like, you know, you don't want a horse to lift their heel against you. He says, one of you is going to do that to me. This is a violent action. And in the other gospels, there's conversations. Ooh, who do you think it is? Who do you think it is? But in this gospel, what his best friend, John, remembers him saying is he says, man, I remember that. He said, guys, I'm telling you this now before it happens so that when it happens, you will know. And what he literally says here is he says, the translation says, I am he. It's the literal words, just I am, that he says throughout this gospel in these climactic moments to say, I am. In other words, the Old Testament name for God, the name that wouldn't even be on the lips of a good and righteous Jewish person, Jesus not only has on his lips, he says, that's me. So here he says, one of the proofs that I am who I say I am is that this betrayal is something I knew in advance. Here's how I think that this responds to our greatest question, our deepest question is, does God know about, care at all, do anything with the horrible stuff that's happened in my life? This is often the question that keeps us from God. Is, yeah, but I've been through terrible things. Does he care? Can he do anything about that? What's interesting here, and I don't want to get too theologically technical and all that stuff, but notice here, and I want to be careful as I can be with my language and represent what's going on in this passage. It says that the devil was the one who put it in the heart of Judas to betray Jesus. In other words, Judas's actions do not come from God. God is not the author of Judas's betrayal. But Jesus knows about it. In other words, Jesus allows it to happen. So while Jesus might not be the source of this ultimately in the way that this is told, Jesus is fully aware that it's happening. And he says, I'm allowing it to happen. Why? Because it is part of the means to get me to the cross. It is part of the means for me to hang on that cross the next day, to which they would say, yeah, Jesus, so stop it. And Jesus would say, even allowing Judas to betray me is but a whisper of the suffering that I will endure on that cross and how much that suffering was foreknown by Jesus and yet was chosen by Jesus. Because though it was awful, though it was real suffering, though Jesus really cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? It was used in the purposes of God for things beyond our possibility of comprehending in the moment. No cross, no resurrection. No cross, no forgiveness of sins. No cross, no church. No cross, no cleansing. No cross, no reconnection to relationship to God. No cross, no hope of eternal life. And Jesus says, I know that you can't understand how this horrible thing that's happening could possibly be used for my purposes. But I'm telling you, Good Friday is called good only and ever because there's a resurrection Sunday on the other side of it. And I think the whisper that Jesus is telling us is he says, I know that this life is full of Fridays and they never feel good in the moment. And they're not supposed to feel good. And I suffered with you. And I know what real pain is. And I know what betrayal is. And I know what it is to be cast aside by those who are supposed to love you. I know, I like really know it. I experientially went through it. But I went through it because there is a God who is able to take the most horrible things in this life and to turn them in his power, in his sovereignty, into something beautiful. Like a, I was trying to even think of it, right? Like a great magician, let's say. Like a great magician who hands you a card and then says, do whatever you want to it. Do whatever you want to it. Now put it back in the deck in tatters and they pull it out. Here's your seven of diamonds or whatever. And you go, how'd you do that, right? Or like this week, I was thinking about the ancient Japanese art of kintsugi, where broken pottery is put back together and precious metals are used to put these things back together. And part of the beauty of the resulting vessel is in the brokenness, is in the repair. There's a couple images of this. And the beauty in the repair both speaks to the value of the vessel and the genius of the artist. This is what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, I am not the source and author of the horrible things of this world, of death, of sin, of rebellion, of the things that you will go to. But there is in my divine power, there is more than enough ability for me to take those things and to turn them into my ultimate purposes in this world. Here's what I can tell you. Here's one of the values of being in a community like this. And maybe you're not around church a lot, but one of the values of communities like this is I can tell you right now that there are people in this community who are sitting there on their Thursday night knowing they're headed into a tough season, knowing they're headed into a Friday that doesn't feel very good right now. There are some living on Friday who are experiencing that suffering, who are in that ache and pain. And I know who some of you are. And then there's some of you who are living in the silence of Saturday because you've gone through the hurt and pain and you're waiting for what's on the other side of it. And you don't see it right now. And it just feels really quiet right now. But I got to tell you that there's also some people in here who know what it's like to live through a Resurrection Sunday, who knows what it's like to look back on the pain of their life and say, I see an artist at work. Because God is not just powerful enough to do these things. He is perfect love incarnate. He is perfect love. You see, powerless love is sentimentality, right? That's a fan. That's all of us watching March Madness going, I really care about Caitlin Clark. No, you don't, right? Like, you're a fan. Like, you care from a distance. And some of us think God is a fan of our lives, interested every now and then, glances in on what we're doing and says, ooh, that's good or that's not good, right? He's not a fan. He's not powerless love. He's also not loveless power. He's not merely power. Some of us see God as this tyrant who just stands at a distance and says, I'll intervene when I want to. I'm perfectly capable of it, but I don't care that much. No, he's at our feet, remember. You see, he is perfect power, perfect love, and this beautiful combination of both. And when we walk with him long enough, we learn that resurrection becomes the rhythm of our lives. It becomes the rhythm of what it means to follow him. And yet we re-enter from time to time, we re-enter our Fridays. And we say, oh God, it hurts again. But the language of faith becomes, and God, I believe that I will one day, maybe it's on the other side of eternity, but God, I know that you turn Fridays good because good Fridays are followed by Resurrection Sundays. That's the hope of this passage. That's what Jesus is pointing to here. In my very favorite book of all time by far, Gilead, it's called, written by Marilyn Robinson. There's an aging character who's writing to his young son, and he's reflecting on the hard things he's been through in his life. And of course, he's a follower of Jesus. He loves him. He's reflecting on just the brutal tragedies he's been in. And he says to this young boy in a letter, he says, I don't know what to say, except that the worst misfortune, and I would just put in here, in the kind, loving providence of God, isn't only misfortune. I don't know what to say except that the worst misfortune isn't only misfortune. Good Friday is a misfortune. It's a tragedy. It's an awful thing that the God of the universe had to endure. And there's a sense in which we don't ever have to shut our eyes to that and say, no, it was good, right? Like, sometimes I think we jump to Good Friday too quickly. But it wasn't only misfortune. In fact, it was the greatest, most fortunate thing that ever happened in the history of the world. Because on that day, the Savior knelt low as he could possibly go, took upon himself the absolute worst of this world, of our individual stories, suffered under the weight of it, felt the forsakenness by God that's at the root of our deepest need, took it into the grave, endured the betrayal that he knew was coming. It is such an interesting thing. All week I was thinking about what a difference it would make if I really believed that every hard thing I'm ever going to go through is something that God knew in advance. And that I would entrust him to weave it the way that he did once and for all, ultimately on the cross, into a resurrection of sorts. That's the promise. That's the hope. But I just want to end by saying one more time to the follower of Jesus, to someone who maybe is skeptical about these things. Man, if I could leave you with one thing to walk away with on this Resurrection Sunday, it's no forgiveness, no presence. That's the issue in all of our lives, is we aren't allowing Jesus. We are Simon Peter saying, Jesus, you will never wash my feet. And Jesus says, if I cannot wash you, you have no part with me. That's where it begins. And that's where we return to again and again. It's why we do this table every week, Jacobswell. Those of you who are around every week, we do this table every week because this is our opportunity to be served by Jesus. Because what this table represents is the bread out on the sides. There's a gluten-free option here. Is Jesus' body broken for us? There's wine and juice. They're labeled for the sake of conscience. The night before Jesus, that same night, that same meal, Jesus says, this will represent my blood poured out for the forgiveness of your sins. My ultimate act of service. And what I love, especially this Sunday as we come to this table, is in the same way that I think the foot washing was meant to make tangible to the disciples what they were going to witness that next horrible day. This makes tangible what we witness 2,000 years later over our shoulders. It makes that tangible. It's as this is Jesus' service to us. And so the band will come up. We'll play just a couple more songs. And what we would invite you to do is to come down these two aisles, the two center aisles. You can choose the gluten-free option here or the bread out on the sides. You take it as the band is doing now and dip it in the wine or the juice, and then you can go out the sides. This table is for followers of Jesus. That's very clear in the scriptures. We're told that you honor him more by simply considering what you've heard this morning rather than coming forward. But if you are a follower of Jesus, or my goodness, why not make today Resurrection Sunday, the day that you finally say, okay, Jesus, okay, if it starts with you serving me, what a beautiful action it would be to allow him to serve you first, maybe the first time in your life, maybe the first time in years, right? In a sense, we are all Paco, right? Waiting for our Father to say, all is forgiven. Come home. Love your Father. This is your opportunity to come and receive that this morning as we sing. Come when you're ready.